From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
Well, we have two very interesting debates going on in the media this week. One is about military tribunals, where actually there's a split in the elites, and so both sides are being heard from. The other is torture, where we find, it seems, a dozen pundits throughout the media have been afflicted with a compulsion to talk about torture.
Today, a debate on military tribunals and torture between FAIR's Steve Rendell and Newsweek's Jonathan Alter. Then, an anti-abortion fugitive on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list says he's responsible for hundreds of anthrax threats sent to women's health clinics last month. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. warplanes continue to bomb the Taliban's last stronghold of Kandahar as U.S.-backed opposition forces move towards the southern city. In the eastern city of Jalalabad, local commanders say the U.S. government has promised military supplies, logistical support, and money to Mujahideen fighters in anticipation of an assault on what they say is an Al-Qaeda hideout in the White Mountains. As pressure mounts on the Taliban, many of the former regime's officials fled Kandahar for Pakistan, ostensibly to visit their families, but presumably with no intention of returning. The stories of rising defections came as the Taliban's supreme leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, ordered his followers to fight to the death to preserve control of Kandahar. The British Foreign Office yesterday ruled out an inquiry into the mass killings of Taliban prisoners during the riot at the Kalaijangi Fort, despite pressure from Amnesty International and the United Nations. The incident left at least 400 people dead, at least 150 of them Taliban prisoners apparently executed by Northern Alliance troops while U.S. advisors were present. One of those advisors with the CIA was killed. There are some reports that the riot was possibly sparked by the two CIN men present beginning to interrogate the Taliban prisoners. Negotiations on Afghanistan's future were dealt a blow when a prominent Pashtun delegate walked out, charging that the ethnic majority Pashtuns was not given enough clout in the new administration. Haji Abdul Qadir was the most senior Pashtun figure in the delegation representing the powerful Northern Alliance and was central to efforts by the grouping, which is dominated by minority Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras, to present itself as representative of the country's complex ethnic patchwork. Qadir's exit came as delegates entered the crucial phase of finalizing lists of delegates to a parliamentary-style Supreme Council, part of a UN blueprint that also provides for a cabinet-style interim administration. Hopes of an agreement were boosted yesterday when the Northern Alliance relaxed its earlier opposition to an international peacekeeping force being sent to Afghanistan. The UN Security Council met last night to agree on a revised plan for sanctions against Iraq amid controversy over U.S. threats to attack Iraq as part of the so-called war on terrorism. Russia, which has previously blocked British and U.S. proposals for what U.S. officials call smart sanctions against Iraq, backed a compromise deal under which a new list of the items controlled by sanctions will take effect in June. In the meantime, existing sanctions will continue. A bomb explosion on a bus in northern Israel has left at least four people dead, including the suicide bomber responsible for the attack. The latest attack comes on the fourth day of a mission to the region by U.S. envoys who are hoping to secure a ceasefire and implement a peace deal. Earlier yesterday, Israeli troops shot and killed two Palestinians at a roadblock in the West Bank, not far from the site of the bus attack. U.S. peace envoy General Anthony Zinni strongly condemned the Palestinian attack but said nothing about the killings by Israeli troops. The Justice Department announced yesterday that foreigners who give investigators useful information about suspected terrorists will be rewarded. Under the new so-called Responsible Cooperation Program, the Justice Department says it will defer deportation indefinitely for immigrants with visa problems and will allow outsiders to enter the country and apply for citizenship if they come forward and speak up. Arab groups and immigrants criticized the program. Marwan Kredi, executive director of the Philadelphia Arab American Community Development Corporation, said it's bribery and disgusting. It's what I would think some authoritarian government in the Middle East would do. President Bush yesterday defended his controversial plans to let military tribunals try non-citizens accused of terrorism and to let law enforcement officials detain and question thousands of foreigners in the United States. Bush brushed aside criticism of the measures, which have been widely condemned as violations of basic civil liberties, saying they would help protect freedom. And Attorney General John Ashcroft said yesterday that Clayton Wagner is the primary suspect in a wave of anthrax hoax letters sent to women's health clinics on the East Coast. Wagner claimed responsibility for some 300 letters delivered to the clinics last month when he showed up with a gun at the Georgia home of an anti-abortion activist last week. Wagner had previously been jailed on firearms and theft charges, testified at his trial that he had stalked clinics for months and stocked up on weapons after God asked him to, quote, be my warrior and kill doctors who provide abortion.
I look at you all, see the love that's sleeping, while my guitar gently weeps. I look at the floor and I see it needs sweeping. Still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know why nobody told you how to unfold your love. I don't know how someone controlled you. They bought and sold you. I look at the world and I notice it's turning, while my guitar gently weeps. With every mistake, we must surely be learning. Still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know how you were diverted. Were perverted too. I don't know how you were inverted. No one alerted you. I look from the wings at the play you are staging, while my guitar gently weeps.
While My Guitar Gently Weeps by Beatles' George Harrison. He died yesterday of lung cancer. He was 58 years old. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The collapsed state of Afghanistan appeared a step closer to getting a caretaker government, with the two main political factions attending UN peace talks and bonds, saying they were close to an agreement on how to share power for a few months at least. The framework of a deal was reportedly struck between the Northern Alliance, the dominant faction whose military commanders control most of the country, and the Rome-based group of exiles loyal to Afghanistan's aged former monarch Mohammad Zahir Shah. In a crucial U-turn, the Northern Alliance agreed to an international force to maintain security in Afghanistan after opposition to international troops being sent into the country. Britain and other European countries have proposed going into Afghanistan temporarily until a force made up of troops from Turkey, Indonesia, and other Muslim countries is formed. Failure to reach agreement on troops threatened to scuttle the talks. Other Afghan groups warned they would boycott the new government being proposed for Kabul because they feared for their safety from alliance troops, who are mainly Tajiks and control the city. Delegates reported progress in other areas. They said they were close to reaching agreement on the shape and membership of an interim government of Afghanistan. It would be Afghanistan's first ever broad-based government in history, and a history scarred by ethnic divisions. We turn now to Charles Michael Ray Inban, correspondent for Free Speech Radio News, to describe the situation. Charles, can you just set the scene for us, Inban? What does it actually look like? Where are you? Where are these talks taking place?
I'm on a boat right now on the Rhine River, which is right next to a main hotel where all the media have gathered. The talks themselves are on the Petersburg, which is up on a hill behind this small town just south of Bonn. The talks are in a very secure location. It's sort of like a castle, basically, on top of this hill that is surrounded by woods. And so it's, you know, very, very secure. No one is allowed in. I think only about 36, 37 journalists were allowed in for the opening. After that, it's all been closed off to the media entirely. So it's a very beautiful setting, very beautiful location for these talks, and a very secure location for the delegates who are up there talking.
Why are you on a boat? Are you taking the afternoon off?
No, the media center itself is on a boat on the Rhine, which is kind of interesting. The media center here was put together in about 2 days' time, I understand, and so they had this leftover boat, and they threw all of the equipment into it. So the actual UN press briefings that you all see on TV are actually on a boat on the Rhine River. So far in Bonn, of course, the meeting started on Tuesday. It was a day late. But once it got going, it looked like it started off with a lot of optimism by both UN officials and the four factions that are involved meeting here from Afghanistan. But now today, after a day of talks yesterday, people seem to be more sober, and now they're getting right down into the nitty-gritty of actually the talks and what they're going to be deciding. So they're a little bit more reserved. It's been going kind of back and forth between optimism and hope that something positive can come out of this meeting and that a new government can be formed in Afghanistan. Right now, they're working on forming, of course, the transitional government or a transitional administration that can be put in place in Afghanistan. While a new government is chosen, hopefully by a democratic process in Afghanistan within the next 2 years.
And this interim government, what does it look like it would be composed of?
Right now, that's what everyone is deciding. The four factions have decided they want to compose an interim government, but they haven't decided yet who's going to be involved in that interim government. The four factions meeting here are a group from the King's delegation in Rome, called the Rome delegation. The Cyprus delegation is another one of the delegations. The United Front, also known as the Northern Alliance, is one of the other delegations. And the Peshawa group is also one of the final delegations meeting here today. Of course, these four groups all have competing interests about how many of their leaders they want on, in the transitional government and in the new government. So that's kind of what's being worked out here. Whether this government will be a democracy, a republic, or what it will look like is still up in the air. It's very unclear yet. UN officials are pushing for a democracy, based on equality and freedom, and of course all those sort of things that we would hope would be involved in any sort of government. But that's all unclear as how it's going to come out in the end. All of the parties involved say they are for freedom, they are for women's rights, and they are for creating a new era of peace, they say, a new era of hope in Afghanistan. Whether this will come about is unclear at this time.
What about women and their role in the talks in Bonn?
There are women in the talks itself. The exact role they're playing is unclear. They say that they have a voice, that they are being heard. Still, several women's groups, such as the Revolutionary Women of Afghanistan, have been excluded from these talks, haven't been allowed in. Many other women's groups say that there needs to be more work done on getting women involved here. Today, there was some positive involvement of the European women's leaders, a group of European women leaders from across Europe, one woman, the president of the Belgian Women's Council, another one, the head of the Equality Commission from the European Parliament, and the president of the German Women's Council, all spoke with the delegations in a special meeting to urge them to get women more involved in the conference, saying that women have to be involved in the forging of this new government, have to be involved in the forging of a constitution if women are going to be involved ultimately in the actual government that takes place. They were demanding a 40% involvement by women, a minimum to be fair in Afghanistan. Whether that will come about also is unclear at this time. However, all the parties involved have made statements that they are, pro-women, or they are pro-having women involved. No one has come out to say, in any of these delegations that they do not want to see women involvement. They all seem to be open to that. So there is some hope there that there will be some equality in this government.
Charles Michael Ray speaking to us from Bonn, where the Afghan transitional government talks are taking place. He is a reporter with Free Speech Radio News. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. As we turn here at home, the war at home, as law enforcement rounds up non-citizens, holds them in secrecy, and moves toward implementing the secretive military tribunals, the U.S. has begun to debate another method of pressing suspected terrorists, torture. There haven't yet been any presidential directives or pleas from the Attorney General to allow such extreme measures, but some FBI investigators have been itching for heavier tools in their interrogations of alleged 911 material witnesses. As one experienced FBI agent told the Washington Post, "We're known for humanitarian treatment, so basically we're stuck. It could get to that spot where we could go to pressure, where we won't have a choice, and we are probably getting there." After FBI agents are said to have offered the traditional inducements to the material witnesses, reduced prison sentences, money, relocation to the United States, new ID cards for themselves and their families if they cooperate, a surprising number of criminal experts say it's time to talk about letting interrogators inject key recalcitrant witnesses with truth serum, extraditing them to countries where authorities have no qualms about subjecting suspects to a ruthless third degree is another option. And while torture likely will remain officially off limits on U.S. soil, Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, one of the country's leading civil libertarians, suggests creating a mechanism where U.S. judges could approve domestic torture warrants if they're convinced such tactics could thwart an imminent attack. In an article in the Village Voice this week, Dershowitz argues against military tribunals, but doesn't rule out torture as an option. Reporting in national newspapers about the previously unthinkable debate about coercive techniques of interrogation often centers on the reported silence of the men being held as material witnesses and the country's fear about new waves of terrorist attacks. We're joined right now by Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and Jonathan Alter, a columnist for Newsweek magazine. Jonathan Alter, let's begin with you. What about this discussion of torture?
Well, first of all, when people hear the word torture, a real red flag goes up, and it's almost as if once they hear it, they feel that any kind of nuanced discussion of it is somehow out of bounds. So my first interest in this is just to say, look, in a democratic society, we can talk about anything, including torture. I don't happen to favor physical torture. I just don't think it's consistent with American values. It's illegal and needs to stay illegal. But I do think that we can have a conversation about things like sodium pentothal, which doesn't have a terrific track record of success, but there are some newer drugs, so-called truth serums, which lead to a little less hallucination and might conceivably be more successful. And I think under the proper court supervision, it's at least worth talking about, weighing to see whether it might work. I noticed recently somebody brought to my attention that Justice Brennan, William Brennan, the great late civil libertarian on the Supreme Court, ruled some years ago that it was constitutionally acceptable to take an involuntary blood sample from a drunk driving suspect, for instance. So there is some precedent for involuntary use of an IV, which is what would be involved in trying to use some truth serum. But going further than that to physical abuse is something that I don't think we can do.
Steve Rendell, Affair.
I think one of the really interesting things about this discussion is that it seems this torture talk seems to only have afflicted pundits. We do know that a couple of Justice Department officials who remain unnamed in the news, have brought it up and said we have to consider the possibility. But otherwise, this affliction only seems to affect pundits. Jonathan, actually, you do endorse torture. You just said in your piece on November 5th, you said that you were against legalizing torture in the U.S. You said that we should use legal forms of psychological torture here. And you suggested that we, quote, transfer some suspects to our less squeamish allies.
Well, I said that just so that people understand the full context. If you call something like what the United States did in Panama, where they played a lot of loud music outside the Vatican embassy where they thought Manuel Noriega was, if you call that torture, you can call it, you know, psychological warfare. You can call it psychological torture, if you will. Then I think that's something that we can explore. You know, again, as I stated pretty clearly, I don't think this should be done outside of court supervision. As far as transferring people abroad, again, I think, you know, we're gonna face cases where it may be there's overlapping jurisdiction, and for instance, they've just seized an Indonesian with what they say, the authorities say, are some strong evidence of connections to the September 11th plot. I'm not sure it's out of bounds, verboten, somehow beyond the pale to suggest that, you know, perhaps the Indonesian authorities maybe should handle it. And what I object to is the notion that if you discuss any of this, if you say, look, this isn't going to be pretty, this is a wartime situation, that somehow in the eyes of Fair and some other critics engaged in reductionist thinking, that you're therefore a torturer or some kind of advocate of whacking people around using cattle prods on them. There are gradations, nuances in the discussion, and I think it's unfortunate to try to stifle them. Of course, it's limited to the pundit class right now, because if the president or somebody else were to get up and start talking about torture, that's not something that any of us would want. So
we have
of course, it's going to be done by commentators.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We're going to come back with Jonathan Alter of Newsweek on the telephone and Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting in our Firehouse studio here on the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Go up with me, I'll walk with you, and so we will walk together, so we will walk together, so we will walk together. Walk with me, I'll walk with you, and so we will walk together as we march along.
Marching to Pretoria, the Weavers. Actually, just a few weeks ago, we had Ronnie Gilbert on the line talking about her experiences today with the group Women in Black, which is being investigated by the FBI and having been a target of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program in the 1960s, her group, the Weavers. And we are talking about torture and military tribunals with Jonathan Alter of Newsweek magazine and Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Well, Jonathan, I don't want to single you out. I mean, in the context that you used about transferring people overseas to our less squeamish allies, you did mention that Saudi Arabia uses beheadings. Now, that's not technically torture, but I just want to make sure that we have the context correct here. And the fact is, I'm glad to hear it if you're pulling back from your original position. But you're not alone. I mean, I was watching a couple of weeks ago, watching the McLaughlin Group, and 4 out of 5 of the panelists weighed in for some form of torture or another. John McLaughlin, Tony Blankley, Lawrence O'Donnell from MSNBC, Tony Blankley from the Washington Times and Rich Lowry. Only Eleanor Clift dissented from the idea of bringing in some form of torture.
Well, see, that's a wonderful example of how, I mean, I think that, you know, FAIR is useful in this regard. I mean, if it's all reduced to, you know, John McLaughlin, thumbs up, thumbs down, torture yes, torture no, that is not a useful kind of political debate. But it's also not useful to say that anybody who, you know, breaks the taboo and dares to try to work through and make a reasoned, a careful argument, steering around a lot of real legitimate barriers, is somehow to be stigmatized for even raising the issue. I think is also not helpful. What you want is a lot of discussion. One of the things that I pointed out in my piece about torture, which almost nobody has noticed in their efforts to score political points on this particular story, is that torture usually doesn't work. You know, it's just setting aside the moral issues, it's ineffective, because what happens is when people are tortured, they to end the pain, they start to talk, but they usually don't tell the truth. And they can waste a lot of police time running around checking out leads that aren't true. And even with truth serum, which I favor trying, oftentimes they get very chatty, but they don't necessarily provide anything useful. So there are a lot of not just moral but practical problems with torture. I quoted an Army colonel on the limitations and practical problems why it's not useful, but that doesn't, you know, that doesn't mean we shouldn't sort of be discussing all of this without finger-pointing about it all the time.
Well, I wasn't. I really reject this notion that somehow you're being persecuted on this.
We're having
a discussion. This is a debate. This is a kind of debate that should be going on all over the country about a lot of different issues where we're not having this debate.
Excellent.
And I'd want to point out that one of the things that you mentioned in yours, but this is just a way to get to Dershowitz, and Dershowitz has had this long-standing idea that torture isn't actually unconstitutional if you immunize the person you're torturing. In other words, the only reason he argues that torture would be unconstitutional is because it would erase the suspect's right against self-incrimination.
The Fifth Amendment, that's
but
correct.
In fact, you know, I mean, that's a very narrow argument based on one narrow part of one amendment in the Bill of Rights. But in fact, torture is illegal. The United States signed, ratified, and executed the UN Conventions against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhumane, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment in 1994.
Absolutely. It goes back, it predates that, and as I stated clearly, and you correctly quoted me, I don't think that we should lift that legal prohibition. But one of the other things that Alan Dershowitz talks about, which I think is useful as an intellectual exercise, is what they call the ticking time bomb hypothetical, which is, you know, it's a good basis for say classroom discussion. It's something that they talk about in Israel quite a bit, where they debate this issue publicly and have now banned torture after allowing it to be legal, some forms of it for some years. But the ticking time bomb hypothetical is, what do you do if you capture, say, an Al-Qaeda member and he has knowledge of an ongoing a terrorist act, a bomb that's set to go off. He knows where it's going to go off and when. You know that he knows, and you need to try to get him to talk. It becomes a very interesting sort of moral dilemma. So I think the notion that these are kind of open and shut cases, and that you can draw a firm line in all circumstances, you know, as Abraham Lincoln quite persuasively wrote, and I think in some cases he went much too far during the Civil War. But these trade-offs between security and liberty are not as tidy and easy as some people would have us believe.
Well, I think we can. I think we can draw a pretty strong line on torture. The fact is that if we signed the torture conventions in 1994, we either meant it or we didn't. You don't sign things like a torture convention to scuttle them when the going gets a little rough. That convention reads, quote, no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification for torture. In addition, there is U.S. domestic law, which says that you may not torture. And both the convention and the U.S. domestic law says that you are equal to the torturer if you transport or in any way cooperate with transporting somebody to be tortured anywhere else.
I think that's a fine law that I would agree with, and as I indicated in my column and have tried to make clear here, I think it's a good, important law. I think it's important to speak out against torture, but I also think you can't shrink from the hypothetical and say, well, that's just a hypothetical, because after September 11th, things that seemed completely out of our realm of consideration, that just were kind of pointless to even hypothesize about or discuss, are suddenly very much within the realm of the possible, and in the case of the World Trade Center, you know, accomplished fact. So we can't just say anymore, well, that's just a hypothetical. Don't bother me with that. That's just a silly intellectual exercise. It's not. It's something that we have to puzzle through, and we're not going to come to any easy answers. I'm not going to say, in every case, I'd be for torturing the person who knew where the ticking time bomb was. But I also think you can't say that it's something that we don't have to at least think about.
Jonathan Alter is on the phone with us from Newsweek, and Steve Rendell is with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. I thought it was interesting, Jonathan Alter, that you talked about an Indonesian suspect who's been arrested, and perhaps the Indonesians should do something to him in line with torture. I mean, certainly the Indonesian...
No, I'm not saying they should necessarily torture him, but maybe, I think there is a case to be made that sometimes if you have Muslims who are in detention, that perhaps the law enforcement directed against them should be Islamic justice. It might go down a little better in the Islamic world if the justice was meted out by other Muslims.
Is it really a religious thing, or is it more when it comes to torture, state terror? I mean, in the case of Indonesia, they're well known not for carrying out religious rites of torture, but the military state trained by the United States has killed and tortured hundreds of thousands of Indonesians, not to mention Timorese, so they certainly would be well positioned to do it to that guy.
Well, and that's an excellent point, given what they did in East Timor. And I'm not saying that, in this particular case, I don't know enough about this case, that I think they should ship this person back to be tortured. But I do think that as a political matter, I happen to favor, for instance, in the issue of international tribunals, military tribunals, I think they should be international. I think it's very helpful for us to have other societies, particularly Muslim societies, involved in meting out justice. Now, if there are situations where this would be a detriment to the process, and it may well be that you're quite right in the case of Indonesia, then I wouldn't favor it. But I don't think that we should have kind of mental blocks in place saying nothing has to change and nothing new in our approach to these issues should be on the table, that we should just proceed as if September 11th didn't happen. We have to free ourselves to think a little bit differently. Does that mean that we have to rationalize torture, advocate torture? No. And I think it's an oversimplification to say that people who want to broaden the discussion are advocating that. But we can try to think anew, as Lincoln said, about some of these issues.
Jonathan,
I think in some
Alter.
Cases they've gone much too far in the Bush administration, but in other cases the response has been appropriate.
Jonathan Alter of Newsweek and Steve Rendell of FAIR.
I don't want to single Jonathan out because, as I mentioned, it seems, I think the thing that's very curious about this is a couple of Justice Department officials speaking anonymously raise this issue, and then all the heavy lifting in the debate is done by pundits. Of course, we have Tucker Carlson at CNN on Crossfire on October 25th, saying, quote, torture is bad. Keep in mind, some things are worse. And under certain circumstances, it may be the lesser of two evils, because some evils are pretty evil, close quote. You have Jay Winnick, a historian, writing in the Wall Street Journal's editorial pages, not exactly endorsing torture, but pointing out that in a case where a suspect was tortured in the Philippines, several atrocious criminal terrorist acts were averted. And he says, he argues, he ends up saying, one wonders, of course, what would have happened if the terrorist had been in American custody. What I find curious about this debate is that it only seems to be going on among pundits who seem to be taking a sort of anonymous official trial balloon and doing sort of all the heavy lifting of
I just, that's just not the way it works. I mean, it's not as if, it's not as if somebody from the government says, well, you know, you and the press can hoist this trial balloon, and we'll see if it goes over, and then maybe we can go ahead and push through our terror agenda, our torture agenda. The way it works is that, you know, you're writing a column, you're trying to provoke some discussion and be provocative, get conversations like this one going, and so you tease out the arguments, and the only part of it, and I like people engaged in critical debate and criticizing it. The only part of it that is annoying to me is when some organizations, and the FAIR newsletter would be included in this, take one sentence from the article, put it in their newsletter, and stigmatize the author as an advocate of torture. And that doesn't help.
Let me ask you something.
Distinctions between psychological interrogation and physical torture, and include some of the nuances involved, including some of the strong problems, moral and practical, of torture.
Jonathan Alter, not referring to your article, but what you just said, talking about this discussion of torture, it seems that people have a mental block against it. Are you suggesting that human rights, as identified and protected by international treaties, are a mental block?
No, I'm not. And I was just down interviewing the head of the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, and I'm very supportive of those kinds of efforts. What I object to is this notion that if you open the conversation, that somehow the American people and other people interested in public affairs around the world cannot be trusted to work through the nuances. Because the subtext of the criticism of those of us who have been opening this conversation is that it's a slippery slope, and once you start talking about it, you legitimize it, and you give aid and comfort to the guys with hoods on their head who want to crush people's skulls. And instead, what we're trying to do is just say, no, nothing in wartime, and maybe we could have a discussion about whether you think we're in a war. I do. Nothing in wartime is off the table for public discussion.
As a practical point, how do you expect countries to cooperate with the U.S. in investigations if we even put torture on the table for discussion? Spain's already refusing to extradite people that they have arrested because of military tribunals and the death penalty here in the United States.
Well, that's a real problem that the Bush administration has. They I think we're learning a hard lesson about our support for the death penalty, which I oppose, it will lessen international cooperation. It will lessen international cooperation if we have these military tribunals as presently constituted, and that's one of the reasons why I strongly think they have to change, and we need to adjust that. But if international cooperation is lessened because in our press we discuss torture in any fashion, let me just finish the point. The onus is then on those who criticize us for having a democratic discussion about everything.
But you're not just talking about discussing it. You're talking about discussing it as a means to decide whether or not to engage in it in this country.
Well, no. I am talking about whether or not to engage in the use of sodium pentothal and some psychological torture, if you will, psychological techniques, which I draw a big distinction between that and physical torture. Now, other people can say, and my friend at the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights says, you know, I think you are absolutely right to just fine to open this all for discussion. He happens to reject my distinction between physical and psychological torture, and that's fine. That's all part of the conversation. But what I reject is the notion that if you try to draw such distinctions and say, well, hey, sodium pentothal is not the same as a cattle prod or whatever kind of distinction one wants to draw, that therefore you are somehow crossing some boundary of legitimate public discussion. And if other nations object to us crossing such boundaries, crossing such free speech boundaries, and want to cooperate less with us as a result of that, they need a better understanding of our vivid, robust public debate in the United States. And that is their concern, not ours. Now, obviously, I think it is helpful to well, actually, some people in the human rights movement have said, you know, this actually helps us in a sense, because when you open up the conversation of torture, you get to the failures of torture and why torture doesn't work, which is one of the things that I was trying to explain in my piece. And you get people's first reaction, their emotional, frustrated reaction after September 11th, in a lot of cases in the United States, is, well, let's torture them. And then if you say, well, hey, I understand the impulse, but there's problems A, B, C, and D with doing this, then their second reaction is a more measured one. And
Steve,
I think
Rendell,
that could be productive.
But it's important to point out that in international law and international legal tradition, that torture, along with genocide and a very small number of other crimes against humanity, are considered among the highest of crimes, the most atrocious of crimes. Do I have time to mention the military tribunals? Because I think we'll find a little more agreement on this.
You have just 1 minute, because we're just about wrapping up.
Just let me say that I think that it's a very interesting debate that's happening about military tribunals. 2 days ago on Wednesday, Senator Leahy came out and was quite critical of this presidential directive. In fact, 2 weeks ago when Bush first proposed this and first signed the executive order, there it was very clear that there was a split in the elites and that we were going to have a real debate like we haven't had on any other issue having to do with the military since September 11th. We had no debate about the bombing, but it was early on that we had William Safire in the New York Times referring to the military tribunals as kangaroo courts. You had Republican politicians like Bob Barr in Georgia very squeamish about the idea. So because there was a split within the elites, because there are Republicans, Democrats, columnists of all stripe arguing about this, we actually get a debate. I think that's a good thing for military tribunals, but I think it also tells us something about why we don't get to have a debate on other things, such as bombing major cities and those sorts of issues.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up as we move on to our last segment, which has to do with terrorism at home, and that is the anthrax threats around this country. And the Justice Department finally, in a news conference, naming Clayton Wagner and saying they believe he is responsible for some of the threats at hundreds of women's health clinics around the country. We have been joined by Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You can go to that website at fair.org, and Jonathan Alter of Newsweek. And they are at, is it newsweek.com?
Newsweek.com is one way to get us. We're on the newsstand.
Thanks both very much. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Oh, trust in me. Oh, I trust in you. Oh, trust in me. Suspicious.
Suspicious, Tent City, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Anti-abortion fugitive Clayton Wagner, one of the FBI's 10 most wanted people, is taking credit for a rash of fake anthrax letters sent to family planning clinics in October. The FBI seems willing to at least consider his claim. Yesterday, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced Wagner had been named by the Bureau as a top suspect in the anthrax hoax. The FBI said Wagner, a self-described anti-abortion warrior, is extremely dangerous. He said he has survival skills and may be heavily armed, not unlike the description of suspected terrorist Osama bin Laden. Wagner was added to the FBI's 10 most wanted list 10 days after the attacks of September 11th. Yesterday, though, was the first time the attorney general had spoken about the anthrax threats received by over 450 women's health clinics and pro-choice organizations in at least 12 states since September 11th. Although all the envelopes tested negative for anthrax, pro-choice advocates say they've been targeted by a case of extreme domestic terrorism. Abortion clinics have been targeted by snipers, bombs, arson attacks, butyric acid attacks, and anthrax threats for decades. Pro-choice groups yesterday said they're heartened by Ashcroft's denunciation of those responsible for anthrax threats, but cautioned that the investigation should also focus on the network of individuals aiding and abetting Wagner, especially the extremist anti-abortion group Army of God. They also urge the Army of God be designated as a domestic terrorist organization by the Justice Department. We're joined by Vicky Saporta, Executive Director of National Abortion Federation. Do you expect the Army of God to be put on the domestic terror list?
We certainly hope that they will be. They need to be named as a terrorist organization. They vocally advocate the murder of abortion providers and using fatal force to advance their political agenda somehow in the name of God. And so we think it's important that they be treated as the domestic terrorist organization that they are.
Frederick Clarkson, how unusual is it? Frederick Clarkson is author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, and you worked at Planned Parenthood working on researching the right wing. How unusual is it that the Attorney General John Ashcroft, an avowed anti-abortion activist himself, actually finally said that women's health clinics were threatened in this country?
Well, it's a first for him, that's for sure. I think he's been protecting his right flank politically in not wanting to offend his base constituency in the Christian right. And on the other hand, he's really alarmed people that he may be holding a double standard of justice. I think that the good news is that everybody below John Ashcroft has been quite concerned and quite vigorous in trying to find Clayton Wagner.
Well, we have been encouraging the Attorney General to come out with such a statement because we thought it was important that anti-choice extremists know that he's taking these threats very seriously so that we won't have a third wave of threats, because we don't know when these letters will cease to be hoaxes and when they'll really begin containing anthrax, because those active in the Army of God have said that they wouldn't hesitate to use anthrax if they really had it. And then hundreds of people will be put at risk, not only abortion providers, but those who are delivering the mail and the packages and emergency response teams. And it's important that those individuals understand how seriously the Justice Department, the FBI, and other law enforcement officials are taking these anthrax threat letters.
Vicky Saporta, what did it take to get Ashcroft to finally deal with women's health clinics that provide abortion?
We have been asking for a meeting with him since early in the summer, when we saw an increase in activity outside of clinics, more aggressive picketing, more criminal activity. And we know how important law enforcement response is to calming things and to decrease the escalation we saw in violence. We've asked for a meeting with him on more than one occasion, and this week we met at the Justice Department with his deputy and others from the FBI and the U.S. Marshals and the task force, because, again, we think that it's important that he came out with a strong public statement. And we've also asked for any number of things through the summer when Wagner escaped, and in the summer when he made the threats on the Army of God's website that he would murder anyone working in or around abortion clinics. We thought it was important to get more resources into the investigation and offer a reward so that he could be apprehended before he carried out his threats to murder an abortion provider. And we were pleased when the FBI did put him on the 10 most wanted list. The marshals already had them on their 10 most wanted list, as did the ATF. But with his placement on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, more resources did go into the investigation. A reward has been offered. And these are all very important steps to serve as a deterrent for others who may want to do copycat crimes. They need to know how seriously law enforcement officials are taking these threats, and that, you know, people are going to go to jail for the rest of their lives, some of them for the threats that they've been making in their criminal activity.
Vicki Saporta with National Abortion Federation. Carol Mason is also on the line with us, professor of American Studies at Hobart William Smith College and author of the forthcoming book, Killing for Life, The Apocalyptic Narrative of Anti-Abortion Politics. Professor Mason, according to Neil Horsley, the self-described abortion abolitionist and founder of the web-based Nuremberg Files hit list and creator of the Christian Gallery News Service website, Wagner suddenly appeared at his Georgia home last Friday afternoon. Horsley wrote online, "I turned to look at the door to my office just as the form of a man filled the doorway. In one motion, he pulled back his coat to show me a large holstered firearm, while simultaneously he commanded me to hold the dog. I obeyed. 'You don't recognize me, do you?' he stated, and then stopped. 'I'm Clay Wagner.'" Carol Mason, can you talk about Clayton Wagner and this terrorist campaign, who he is and who Horsley is?
I think Wagner is a very dangerous man. There's no doubt about that. And I think his going to Neil Horsley is definitely to get some publicity and to make it known that he's on this campaign. I think that it's important to realize that Wagner's ideas, however, are not the product of a lone, crazed, fringe lunatic, but are derived from some anti-abortion campaigns targeting clinic workers since 1992. We've had anti-abortionists who've targeted clinic workers with what the anti-abortionists themselves called guerrilla legislation. And the fact that Wagner wants people to quit their jobs, the language that he's put his demands in, shows me that he's operating under some of these same ideas. He's not targeting just doctors, and although there have been anti-abortion campaigns to target doctors with what they call guerrilla legislation and lawsuits, Wagner is specifically, and this is on Horsley's website, is specifically saying that doctors have protection and that he's going after the clinic workers who don't have so much protection, and saying that if they want to escape his wrath, if they want to escape being murdered, that they should go to Horsley's website and post some information telling that will help validate or confirm to Wagner that they've quit their jobs. And what this means is one of two things: either that Wagner has a very sophisticated database on which he could confirm this information, and that's what he has claimed, but it also means that it could be that he's trying to compile a database of clinic workers to be targeted either by violent means, the murders that he's saying that he will commit, and I think he's a credible person, I think we should believe that, either by violent means or by nonviolent anti-abortion campaigns that do terrorize people and harass people but are considered nonviolent and non-terroristic.
Can you talk about what exactly Clayton Wagner has done at this point, and any kind of comparisons of here we're bombing Afghanistan, putting all resources, the U.S. government, into finding Osama bin Laden. Yet here you have Clayton Wagner on the top 10 FBI list, domestic terrorist, who it is clear he was in Georgia just in the last few days. And the U.S. government can't find him, can't find, what was his name, Eric Rudolph,
right.
Who it's believed was responsible for a number of bombings.
Right. I think it's good that you link this with Eric Rudolph, because it's clear to me that being on the web so much, having this meeting with Horsley got him a lot of attention, and he's very much trying to narrate himself in terms of Eric Rudolph, who was seen more or less as a folk hero, not as a martyr, but as a sort of a fugitive. And I think he's definitely sort of doing the same thing that that Eric Rudolph's case did, which was sort of to show the FBI's incompetence and to thumb his nose at the federal law enforcement. And in doing so, he's very much trying to draw on this idea to get the people behind him, to get Americans behind him, to help him out, and possibly to inspire other people to take up arms and to do their own vigilante or guerrilla actions.
I want to thank you very much for being with us and all of our guests. We're going to certainly continue to follow this issue. Carol Mason, professor of American Studies, Hobart William Smith College. Frederick Clarkson, author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. And Vicki Saporta, executive director of the National Abortion Federation. And that does it for this program today. I'll be headed to Los Angeles. I'll be at Scripps College tonight, Friday night, and Saturday night with Danny Glover and Fire WBAI program director Bernard White, along with a number of people from KPFK, the Fire, the band, as well as current staff. We'll be showing the video highlights of Democracy Now in Exile. And we'll be in Los Angeles at the First Baptist Church, 760 South Westmoreland Avenue. You can get the latest information on that, again, with Danny Glover, tomorrow night, 7:30 to 10, at our website, as you can get links to all of our guests and information on the program at democracynow.org. Jackie Suen is our webmeister. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner and Suganya Mahendran. Our video team, Orlando Richards, Rachel Jones, Emily Kunstler, Karen Renucci, Corinna Escamilla, Noel Rabinowitz, and Dee Dee Halleck. Thanks to Amy Pomerlo at KPFA, KPFA staff in general, and KFCF in Fresno, Pacifica affiliate stations around the country who are airing Democracy Now!. We are Pacifica. We're broadcasting from Downtown Community Television, a firehouse in Chinatown in Manhattan, thanks to John Alpert and Keiko Suno, broadcasting on public access TV stations around the country in New York, Manhattan Neighborhood Network on Channel 56 and Channel 34, CUNY TV, as well as on Dish Network, Channel 9415. That's Free Speech TV's 24-hour channel. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.